my aunt taught at one of the big institutes which were inaugurated by the Empress Catherine for the daughters of the nobility. And she gave English lessons there. She had a small flat in St. Petersburg where I stayed.
After you'd stayed with your aunt for a little while, presumably she was working, what did you do to fill the time? What happened?
I think I was a bit of a bore for my aunt, and we decided to go and see the librarian of the British Embassy. And he was a sort of agents for governesses and so on. And he very kindly introduced us to Mr. and Mrs. Strook, who had an only daughter who'd only just left school, and they wanted a companion for you, as his factory was a long way out of Petersburg, and she had nothing, no friends and nothing at all to do, and so they decided they wanted an English companion for her. And I went there and had a very happy time. They were marvellous people. After the strokes, I went to Prince Lvov, to his daughter Anna. We were the same age, and they had a lovely villa in Strelna, which was about an hour by rail from St. Petersburg.
When you were living with the Lvovs and companion to Princess Anna, what sort of a day did you have?
Well, in the mornings we studied. We had tutors coming from St. Petersburg for music, German, drawing and painting, French lessons. In the afternoon we played tennis. Either we had parties there or we went to the Grand Duke Alexei. He had two sons and a nephew who were cadets at the military academy. During the summer, of the holidays were quite long, and we played tennis, skittles, croquet, and thoroughly enjoyed ourselves.
And your role in all this was, I suppose, to speak English all the time?
Speak English, yes. I spoke English all the time. And they all spoke English. The boys spoke excellent English because they'd always had governesses. They were about 16, 17, you know. And charming, well-mannered young men. And we were great friends.
These summer villas that the Russian aristocracy had, yes, that we read about, were they really palatial?
Beautiful. Lovely grounds. And enormous houses, they were beautifully overlooking the Finnish Gulf. The road where this villa was what they called the lower road, and it was just a line, one palace after another, occupied by the various Grand Dukes, as far as Peterhof, where the Emperor's villa was. He didn't live in the palace. There is a palace there. But he had a villa overlooking the sea, which was, of course, magnificent. And on one occasion, we were taken there and shown. The imperial family had only left that morning, and the toys in the nursery and everything were just as they'd left them. One of the things I remember most was going into the Emperor's dressing room, which was an enormous room overlooking the sea. And as one walked in, what attracted my attention was a large portrait of the Emperor Wilhelm. And written was, "To dear Nicky, with all my love from Willie." That was very funny.
And did you ever see the Tsar during those summers at Peterhof?
Yes, occasionally. One saw him driving when he went to see Shishinsky his ex-girlfriend, the ballerina Shishinsky. And we always knew when the emperor was likely to drive by, because the road, the lower road, was lined with secret police.
Of course, this idyllic Russian family life, well-to-do, couldn't go on forever. Changes were coming. When were you aware that your world was going to alter?
That was when my husband came into my bedroom one morning and said, Rasputin has been killed. This is the beginning of a revolution. And he was quite right. When the revolution really started, he was engineer for the whole of a large district, and there was a carpenter who had great influence amongst the red workers. And he became the engineer, and as a result, the whole of the transport was to stop, because what a chance had a carpenter for knowing how to run a railway. So that was really when we realized that life was never going to be the same. And then when the Turks joined, of course, they joined the Russians, and they invaded the Caucasus. And that was when we left Baku, when the Turks were invading the city. And within 48 hours, we were on a ship going to Astrakhan, where we imagined that we should be safe. In the meantime, the Red Army were fighting the whites all over the country, but they hadn't got as far as the Volga, so to the Volga we went. In Astrakhan, we got onto another boat and went up the Volga. We stayed at a small place called Khvalinsk. It was really a large village, and we were able to find accommodation, and we spent the summer there. And one of the things that I remember so well was the heat. It used to be as hot at midnight as it was in the daytime, and you could see like a sea of wheat as far as you could see, brightening, just golden sea. And we stayed there until one night there was a rumour that the Red Army were not far away. We didn't believe them. At 4 o'clock in the morning, shooting began. And there were shells falling all over. The school was set on fire. We were staying with a man whose house had just been built. And in those parts, they dug deep holes in the ground and filled them with ice, great blocks of ice. And that was how they kept their food. And so he put us all, threw mattresses down on top of the ice, and we all climbed into these ice boxes. Into this ice, big ice box that he had there. And we were there for quite a time, and then I suffered from claustrophobia. I couldn't stand it. So I got out, took the children out into the fields. I thought that we should be safer in the fields than in the village.
But of course the Reds eventually did catch up with you, didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, in Samara. We went to Samara, found a flat there. My children were ill. We couldn't, when the Red Army was advancing. An Englishman came and said that there would be a room on the train that they were taking to go to Siberia, but I couldn't take them because I had two children ill. And so we stayed on there for just over a year.
When you left Baku and went on your travels thinking the Reds were coming,
yes.
Presumably your husband left his job then.
Yes.
How did you exist with all these travels and for money?
Well, it was a custom in Russia for the husband to always give You had a child that gave you a handsome present for jewellery, and I had quite a lot of it, which we sold. I had to sell for various reasons. And any jewellery that I had left when I got out of Russia was sewn up in a teddy bear that my little boy loved and never parted from. And did I keep my eyes on that teddy bear? He was stuffed with jewellery. My great idea was to get the children to England, to get them to school, to get them back to a normal life. And we decided to do whatever we could. And eventually we got to Tiflis. Again, a 12-hour journey by train took us 4 days because we were shunted from one station to another. We were without food. In the daytime it was warm and at night it was freezing, and we were in cattle trucks. Cattle trucks, yes. Then we arrived in Tiflis, and my great idea was to get to England. And I saw the High Commissioner, Colonel Stokes, who said he would do all he could to help. And eventually, by selling jewellery, and we were able to get the fares. We were always selling things. Had to sell everything you would have had, I mean, to live. And we caught a boat from Batum to Constantinople, and from Constantinople to Marseille. And on the 7th of February, we arrived in England in 1921. And that was the end of our journeys from Russia.
When you eventually arrived in England with your children, how old were you then?
I think I was 34, 35.
And how were you able to use your time and your life in Russia to go on existing in England? And
eventually, as I had learnt during those years when we were on our own without staff, to cook, and being a Yorkshire woman, I was interested in cooking, and we went into a restaurant in London, and eventually, by borrowing money and again selling jewellery, we were able to become owners of this restaurant, which I ran for 26 years.